Warning, the following podcast may discuss topics of violence that may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome back to Above and Beyond. As always, I'm your host, Philip Kesterson, and tonight we are taking a trip back to Texas, because we are going to be talking about Francis Augustus Hamer, better known as Frank Hamer, better known as the man who led the posse who hunted down Bonnie and Clyde. And I don't really have any housekeeping for tonight, so we're just going to hop right into it. So Frank Hamer, or Francis Augustine Hamer, was born March 17, 1884, in Fairview, Wilson County, Texas. When he was younger and he wasn't working on the family's ranch, he would keep his time occupied by working at his father's blacksmith shop. He also worked on Welch Ranch in San Saba County, and then he lived in Oxford, Texas. And what's funny about Oxford, Texas is later on in his life when he became a Texas Ranger, he would joke that he was the only Ranger who was Oxford educated. Did not have an education past about the sixth grade, but he showed phenomenal intellect. His math skills were absolutely insane and unheard of for somebody in his situation at the time. He had an eidetic memory. He also loved history, specifically the history of the Texas Ranger and local Native American tribes. By the turn of the 19th century, he had gathered a good reputation as a farmhand, and the reputation turned into a reputation of law in 1905 while he was working on the Carr Ranch. He captured a horse thief, and the local sheriff was so impressed by the way that he took down this horse thief that he actually recommended that Hamer join the Texas Rangers. One of the reasons that he was suggested this is because on top of chasing down this horse thief, Hamer also had a unique outlook on criminals. He saw criminals as animals, not necessarily in a bad way or like seeing them as cruel or anything like that. He saw them as predictable in terms of their characteristics. He once said, quote, "The criminal is a coyote, always taking a look over his shoulder." He spent a lot of time outdoors, which made him really good with knowing the lay of the land, knowing how to track things, and overall outdoorsy stuff, that it was a good thing for him to join the Texas Rangers. And in 1906, he began patrolling the Mexican border along with Captain John H. Rogers, Company C, out of Alpine, Texas, of the Texas Rangers. Many times throughout his adult life, he would leave and rejoin the Rangers. 1908 was the first time he would leave the Rangers, and this was to become the city marshal of Navasota, Texas. Here, he enforced law and order and cracked down hard on the town, turning it into a town that did not have, quote, "shootouts on Main Street so frequent that in the 2 years, at least 100 men died." In 1911, he worked as a special investigator in Houston, and in 1914, he became the deputy sheriff of Kimball County, assigned specifically to livestock theft, because he was so good at it. A year later, in 1915, he would rejoin the Rangers and was stationed around Brownsville, right on the Texas-Mexico border. Here he took part in engagements during the Bandit Wars, and what the Bandit War was a series of raids from 1915 to about 1919. It's a small-scale engagement that would take place during the Mexican Revolution. The Texas Rangers were heavily involved on the U.S. side for this little altercation, and the U.S. Army also deployed some troops in the region. Some of the U.S. troops that were deployed here, like the actual army troops that were deployed here, this would be some of the experience that they would gather prior to the U.S. involvement in World War I. During this time, he also encountered many bootleggers, as this was also during the Prohibition era, although it would not officially begin for a few more years. He then left the Rangers again and joined the Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association, which was an organization specifically aimed at preventing livestock theft. In 1917, he married his second wife. And I say second wife, I know that I never mentioned the first wife. I purposely did not mention the first wife because the first one, he was married back in 1911, but it was only like a month or two long, so it wasn't really noteworthy to mention. But his second wife, her name was Gladys Sims. And what is funny about this marriage is that her, along with her brother, was actually accused of murdering her previous husband. This led to a feud between her family, the Sims, and her ex-husband family, the Johnsons. One of the big events that happened during this marriage was in October of 1917. Frank and Gladys were traveling with three others, and they stopped to repair a flat tire that they had. They stopped on the side of the road. And while they were stopped here, a man named G. McMeans and H.D. Phillips approached the car. McMeans approached from the front, Phillips approached from the back, and their aim was to kill Frank and Gladys. Now, two of the three people that Frank and Gladys were traveling with had stepped away to go to the bathroom. They weren't involved. It wasn't a setup, nothing like that. They just happened to not be there. And McMeans and Phillips opened fire. Well, Hamer managed to get out, and he wrestled McMeans. Hamer actually got shot twice during this. Well, while they were fighting on the ground, Phillips pulled out a shotgun, walked up, and started to shoot Hamer. But Gladys yelled out, like, I don't know what she yelled out, probably like, hey, my man's got a shotgun to the back of your head. Well, Hamer was able to wrestle the gun away from McMeans and start shooting at Phillips. Phillips started to run away, and McMeans saw that Phillips was running away, so he also tried to run. But Frank actually shot and killed him. It's funny because this happened directly in front of a courthouse where there just happened to be a court case going on. So a lot of the jurors that were in that court case come to the window and pretty much watch the end of this whole thing. And they did arrest Frank, but he was eventually released on terms of justified homicide, which, I mean, if two men jump you while you're changing a flat tire and you manage to kill one and chase the other off, I feel like no one's really going to take you, like, mess with you, you know what I mean? After this, he left the Cattlemen's Association and joined a prohibition unit until he was transferred to Austin in Texas in 1921 to serve as a senior ranger captain. In 1922, he led fights against the KKK, and this is probably one of the cooler, obviously not talking about the big part of Frank Hamer's life, but this is one of the cooler things that he did. He was very, very against the KKK. He fought against them a lot in Texas. He is personally responsible for saving 15 people from lynch mobs, with the exception of one man named George Hughes. Now, what happened with George Hughes was he was a suspect in a rape trial, and a few rangers, along with Frank Hamer, were deployed around this courthouse to protect him. But a lynch mob caught word that this is where he was being held, and they decided to attack the courthouse and take matters into their own hand. Well, Frank and the other rangers managed to kill a couple of the people in the mob, but ultimately, they were forced to fall back. The mob set fire to the courthouse and then took some dynamite and put it up against the vault that George Hughes was being held in, and it blew the vault open. They went in, took him, and then they hung him from a tree outside. It was never proven whether or not he actually did what he did, but that's kind of the way lynch mobs roll. They don't really care if it happened or not. It just takes one rumor to spark everything, and then it's, you know. After they did this, the mob then rampaged the Black District of town, but the rangers were outnumbered, and they were ordered to fall back out of town. And Frank Hamer didn't want to do this. He felt that it was his obligation and the obligation of his men to defend the Black District that was under attack. But ultimately, as I said, he was ordered to, so he had to pull back. So fast forward to 1928, Frank Hamer took down a murder-for-hire ring. And now I'm going to try to explain this as best as I can, because as I was reading up to it, it kind of sounded weird, but I'm going to attempt to explain it. So Texas's bank system started offering $5,000 bounties for dead robbers. They didn't want live ones. They specifically wanted dead robbers. Now, $5,000 in 1928 dollars, $5,000 today is roughly about $80,000. So in 1928, in the Texas bank system, if you took a dead robber, quote unquote, a dead robber to the bank system, they would pretty much hand you $80,000. And you can kind of see where an issue with this rises is somebody doesn't necessarily have to be a robber. The bank just has to think that they are. Hamer felt that those cashing in on these bounties were innocent people to get the money. They were exploiting homeless people, people who were just down on their luck. It's kind of the same way that the Salem witch trials took off. It's just you blame somebody that you didn't like and you cashed in on it. He actually wrote an expose titled "The Banker's Murder Machine" and gave out copies at the state capitol. And although public outcry led to investigations and indictments, the bank held their stance, and more bounty killings happened well into the 1930s. Now, officially, Frank Hamer retired from the Texas Rangers in 1932, but he was still allowed to keep his commission as an active senior captain. When he retired, he was still used for references, and he trained a little bit of the other Rangers. But none of the stuff that I've talked about beforehand is what at least in my opinion, what warranted him having his own episode. It's what he did against two of the most famous outlaws in history that landed him a spot on the show. But before we get into that, I'm going to pause for a word from our sponsors. So now we're going to talk about Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow. Probably one of the most famous couples in history. Definitely the most famous couple to come out of the 20th century. I mean, you can't say Bonnie without saying Clyde after. So Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow, they would have met somewhere in January of 1930. Clyde had been a criminal long before he met Bonnie. The first time he was actually arrested was for failing to return a rental car, which, considering all the things that they did, I think that's hilarious to me. People always wonder why Bonnie Parker can go along with the things that Clyde did. The most obvious reason is love. It's pretty widely accepted that she fell pretty hard for him, and she was willing to literally follow him to their deaths because of it. The two formed a small gang and would carry out robberies all over the place. They would rob banks, they would rob gas stations, restaurants. But the thing is they never really took more than about $1,500 from each. There was even one account where they robbed a restaurant and only left with about $30. The gang wreaked havoc across the Midwest from Texas to Minnesota. In May of 1933 alone, they managed to successfully rob banks in both Lucerna, Indiana, and Akabina, Minnesota. So it proves that they would cover a lot of ground really, really fast. But with how fast they were robbing these places, it makes sense because they were constantly on the run. So now here's something that personally I grew up wondering. After reading stuff that Bonnie and Clyde did, I always wondered why people idolized them so much. And partially it's because due to Hollywood, I believe there's a movie that comes out in 1967 about Bonnie and Clyde. And it kind of romanticized them. And I think, I'm not going to say obviously not that alone, but I think that played a large part in the way that people idolize it, at least today. But if you back to the 1930s, when they were still alive, you got to remember, 1930s, this is during the Great Depression. In 1929, the stock market crash launched the United States and parts of Europe into the Great Depression. It was a horrible time economically. And I think one of the reasons that people turn to this story so much is because when you listened to the radio or you picked up a newspaper, all you saw was these horrible stories about how bad the economy was. But now suddenly you have something else, something that it wasn't a one and done thing. It was something that every single day there was something going on with them. There was a new robbery. There was a new fight. There was something to keep people focused. So it was fresh. They also only went after banks sometimes. I read somewhere that they hit up dozens of banks, and then I read somewhere that they only hit about 15 banks. So it's kind of like take your pick of which one you choose to believe. I couldn't find one hard evidence for one way or hard evidence for the other. But when the Great Depression happened, people largely blamed politicians. They blamed banks and stuff like that. So when they're robbing these banks, people are seeing them as modern day Robin Hoods. Also, another reason that they could have been idolized so much is one of the more obvious ones. It's that they were lovers on the run. These were two kids that put their love over everything else. And yeah, they did all these crimes, and yeah, they did all this bad stuff and everything. But at the end of the day, it showed that they were willing to go through everything together. But the reality of these two is that they were cold-blooded murderers, and they would kill anybody who got in their way. 1934 is kind of the year, well, it's not kind of, it is the year that everything started to go south for Bonnie and Clyde. In early January of 1934, Bonnie, Clyde, and a man named Jimmy Mullins raided East Ham Prison Farm in Texas. During this, they freed four people that would go on to be in their gang. The reason that they were so successful is that Clyde had actually served prison time in this camp. And he knew the routines, he knew where officers would be. They stationed weapons so that when a signal was released, the inmates, two of the four who escaped, grabbed those guns and then they made their escape. What's funny though, is when Clyde was in this prison system, he cut off two of his toes so that he wouldn't have to do the hard labor that you have to do at these camps. But just 2 days after he cut his toes off, he was paroled. So he did it for nothing, and it left him with a permanent limp for the rest of his life. That's something that goes on with Bonnie and Clyde, is during most of their stuff, they both have a limp. Clyde because he cut off his toes. Bonnie because they her and Clyde got into a car accident, and she messed up her leg. During this escape, two officers were shot that were overseeing the labor part of the camp. One died a few days later, and then one survived. Now, this was a huge embarrassment to the Texas Department of Corrections, and the prison administrator for the correction system, Lee Simmons, was under stress from the Texas governor, Miriam Ferguson, so he suggested the idea to bring in Frank Hamer out of retirement to hunt down Bonnie and Clyde. And at first, Governor Ferguson was against it, but Simmons ultimately convinced her that this was probably the best thing to do. Ferguson wasn't the only one that was against it. Frank Hamer himself was against it. But the more that he saw reports of things that Bonnie and Clyde did, like, they got more violent, they got more frequent. He knew that he couldn't just sit idly by and let this happen. So he took Simmons up on his offer of hunting them down for about $180 a month. What's funny is that this is kind of like a real-life Hollywood moment. What you have is Frank Hamer, this Texas Ranger who's retired, and now there's a greater threat, and they have to come crawling back to him and beg him to come out of retirement. It's amazing to me. So once Hamer started looking into Bonnie and Clyde, like looking at their past cases and stuff that they've done, it didn't take him long to realize that they had a trail that they would follow. It alludes back to him likening criminals to animals, as he feels that they're creatures of habit. Their anchor points for their trails, for the area of operation, was Dallas, Texas, Joplin, Missouri, and somewhere in northwest Louisiana, but sometimes they would venture a little further out just for bank robberies. The Barrow Gang would rob banks in Lancaster, Texas, Pateau, Oklahoma, and the towns of Rembrandt, Kinnearum, Stuart, and Everly, Iowa. So you can kind of see how far out they're getting. Hamer was always on their trail, though. Wherever they went, he was right on them, but they always seemed to be one step ahead of him. However, he was learning their movements more, and he was closing in on them. At one point, he even said, quote, "When I began to understand Clyde Barrow's mind, I felt that I was making progress." So Bonnie and Clyde, their gang is responsible for the deaths of around a dozen people, a little over a dozen, mostly police officers. But now I'm going to talk about the one that sticks out the most to me. It sticks out to me, one, because of what happened, but two, because this was also the point where the public started to really see them as outlaws instead of these Robin Hood figures. At the top of the show, at the top of every show, I put a warning for violence, but this is probably the first time that that actually comes into play. So I'm going to again say that listener discretion is advised. So on April 1st, 1934, it's Easter Sunday. Since they were always on the run, they would rest wherever and whenever they could. And this one time, they were asleep on the side of the road when two motorcycle cops, E.B. Willer and H.D. Murphy, approached them, thinking that they needed help or thought that they were just passed out drunks. Now, Bonnie Clyde and a man named Henry Methvin, who comes into play later, they saw them coming up. They got a little bit worried, and Clyde supposedly said, "Let's take them." Now, what he was most likely meaning was, "Let's kidnap them because we can use them later." Well, Henry Methvin thought that he meant, "Let's just shoot him." So he opened up fire, and he killed E.B. Willer on the spot. H.D. Murphy, however, started to pull back, and Clyde shot him. Now, he didn't die instantly. When he hit the ground, he was still alive. And what makes this incident so bad is that Bonnie Parker got out of her car, walked over to him, kicked him over so that they were looking face to face, and made him look her in the eyes, and then she put a shotgun shell through his head. Now, witnesses said that after Bonnie Parker shot H.D. Murphy in the head, she turned around, walked back to the car, and as she was walking back, she was kind of laughing to herself, and she said at one point out loud, quote, "I like the way his head bounced like a rubber ball on the road." Now, the guy that she killed, Holloway Daniel Murphy, he was 22 years old. He'd only been on the force about 6 months, but this was his first day out on patrol, and he was about to get married not too long after this. Now, what's sad about the way he died, of course it's sad that he died, but specifically what's sad about the way he died is because he was new, because he was so young, the shotgun that he carried, he would always carry the two shells in his pocket because he was so scared that the shotgun was going to go off, and he didn't want to hurt anybody accidentally, so he always kept the shells in his pocket. Well, when the police got to his body, he had those two shells in his hand. He never even got them in the gun to fight back. His funeral was publicized, and at his funeral, his would-be wife wore her wedding dress. And when the public saw this, they were like, okay, maybe we've taken this story a little too far. Somebody needs to do something about these two. That was kind of the beginning of the end for Bonnie and Clyde, at least publicly. The real beginning of the end for Bonnie and Clyde would be March of 1934. By this time, Henry Methvin, and I said that name earlier, he was one of the three that shot one of the motorcycle cops. His family had begun to grow tired of his involvement with the gang. So they went to Benville Parish, Louisiana Sheriff Henderson Jordan about him, and they informed him that they don't want him involved in this anymore. So they basically told them, the sheriff, where the Barrow Gang was going to be. And when Frank Hammer caught wind of this, he put aside his lone wolf mentality and he formed a posse. Now, the six people who were in the posse were Frank Hammer, Henderson Jordan, the sheriff, Prentice Oakley, former Texas Ranger Manny Gault, Bob Alcorn, and Ted Hinton. The plan was Henry Methvin's father, who Frank Hammer had convinced that this was the best way that they needed to do this. He was going to pull off to the side of the road, pretend he needed assistance with his vehicle, and then when Bonnie and Clyde drove past him, the idea was they would see him and offer help, and then they would take him out. So here's how this actually went down. May 23rd, 1934, around 9 o'clock in the morning, Clyde pulls their Ford V8 off the shoulder to help Henry Methvin's father, who is actually on the side of the road. Frank Hammer steps in front of the car, reportedly yells, "Stick 'em up," and aimed at the two. Before either Bonnie or Clyde could react, the rest of the posse emerged from the woods. They fired over 150 rounds into the vehicle. Now, just to be sure and to not take any chances, Frank Hammer approached the vehicle with a sidearm and shot both of them in the head once more, just to make sure they were dead. Now, Frank Hammer later talked, one of the few public times he talked about this, he said that he genuinely did not know if he would be able to shoot a woman. But when he aimed the gun at them through his head, ran everything that they had done, all the people they have killed, all the people they have hurt, and it wasn't an issue for him anymore. He really, really disliked talking publicly about it. He turned down multiple deals from media outlets about the story. Like, he refused to talk about it, really. And like I said, he really had an issue with shooting Bonnie. Not as much Clyde, but Bonnie specifically because she was a woman and because she was kids. At the time of their death, Bonnie was 22 and Clyde was 24. He had to. It also disgusted him to see what people did as the bullet-riddled Ford was towed back into town. I mean, these people were vultures. They were trying to rip clothes off of the two of them. There were reports that women were using like bandanas and stuff to try to get some of their blood. Someone tried to cut off Clyde's trigger finger. It's disgusting. And Frank Hammer watched this as they were bringing this back to town, and it appalled him. But following the takedown of Bonnie and Clyde, Hammer spent the rest of the 1930s as private security for oil company. He, along with a group of other former Rangers, took part in both the 1935 Gulf Coast Longshoremen Strike and the 1936 Gulf Coast Maritime Workers Strike. He was a strike breaker. His job was to go in and stop these strikes. Something funny that he did is at the outbreak of World War II in 1939, he, along with 49 other former Rangers, offered their services to King George VI. In case the Nazis tried to invade England, he offered that they could go to the Buckingham Palace and protect him. And King George was like, no, we're okay. Thanks, though. And then in September of 1948, he was again brought back into service as a Ranger to accompany former Texas Governor Coke Stevenson to examine tally sheets for an election that were rumored to be frauds, and the person he was running against was Lyndon B. Johnson, who would become president in 1963 after Kennedy was assassinated. And when they showed up to this building, there were two groups that were standing outside the building that had the election results, and Frank Hammer went up to one of them and told him to get out of there, and they kind of scurried off, and then he looked at the other group, walked up to them, and I don't know what he said, but they ran off too. So you don't really mess with Frank Hammer, especially with the notoriety he had of, oh, hey, I'm the one that took down Bonnie and Clyde. Now, he retired for good in 1949 to Austin, Texas, and in 1953, he suffered a heat stroke that he just never recovered from. Like, it messed him up. It messed his health up pretty bad, and he just never recovered from it. And it led to his death on July 10th, 1955. Through the course of his career, he was shot 17 times and left for dead about 4 or 5 times, but still managed to find his way back to wherever he was trying to go. And he's credited with about 53 to 70 kills during his time as a Ranger. But of course, like I said, the most important thing he did was he formed a posse, he set up this trap, and he ended the reign of Bonnie and Clyde. Now, who knows how long they could have possibly gone had he not did the things that he did and not stepped up to the plate. He could have easily sat on the side and been a spectator, but he knew that he couldn't do that, like morally or ethically. He just could not do that. But that's going to wrap it up on this episode on Francis Augustus Hamer. As always, I'm Philip Kesterson, and we do have the email set up at above.beyondpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that is above.beyondpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/aboveandbeyondpodcast. And I will see you next week on Above and Beyond.